Discourse on The End of the Revolution and the Beginning of Independence by Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom. Episode 5. Cambridge, Massachusetts, September 2, 1774. On the evening of August 31st, Boston patriots noticed significant troop movement in and around Boston. Concerned that they might be going to Salem to arrest the committee members, word was sent to Salem. The Salem committee responded that they were ready to receive any attack that they might be exposed to for acting in pursuance to the laws and interest of their country as became men and Christians. The Boston Evening Post on September 5th tells us the purpose of the troop movements. On Thursday morning, half after 4, about 260 troops embarked on 13 boats at Long Wharf and proceeded up Mystic River to Temple's Farm, where they landed and went to the Powder House on Quarry Hill in Charleston Bounds, where they took 212 half barrels of powder, the whole store there, and conveyed it to Castle William. A detachment from this corps went to Cambridge and brought off 2 field pieces. General Gage had been notified that the patriots had begun seizing powder from various stores and sought to head them off, at least, where it could be safely accomplished. These events, however, had an impact on the patriot side. On Friday morning, September 2nd, by 8 o'clock, over 3,000 farmers had arrived at Cambridge Common, and more were on the way. They had left their firearms, but most were equipped with large sticks. Later reports indicated that 1/4 to 1/2 of the patriots were armed. They wanted to show their strength, but they did not want to confront the British. In Boston, word spread that tens of thousands of country people were on their way to Boston. John Andrew wrote, 4 or 5 expresses have come down to Charleston and here, in Boston, to acquaint us that between Sudbury and this, above 10,000 men are in arms and are continually coming down from the country. That their determination is to collect about 40 or 50,000 by night, which they are sure of accomplishing, when they intend to bring in about 15,000 by way of the Neck, and as many more over the ferry when once got possession, to come in like locusts and rid the town of every soldier. In an effort to ward off an open confrontation, the Cambridge Committee contacted Lieutenant Governor Thomas Oliver, as described by Oliver. Early in the morning, a number of the inhabitants of Charleston called at my house to acquaint me that a large body of people from several towns in the country were on their way coming down to Cambridge, that they were afraid some bad consequence might ensue, and begged I would go out to meet them and endeavor to prevail on them to return. In a very short time, before I could prepare myself to go, they appeared in sight. I went out to them and asked the reason of their appearance in that manner. They respectfully answered that they came peaceably to inquire into their grievances, not with design to hurt any man. I perceived they were landholders of the neighboring towns and was thoroughly persuaded they would do no harm. I was desired to speak to them. I accordingly did in such a manner as I thought best calculated to their minds. They thanked me for my advice and said they were no mob, but sober, orderly people who would commit no disorder, and then proceeded on their way. I returned to my house. Soon after they had arrived on the common at Cambridge, a report arose that the troops were on their march from Boston. I was desired to go and intercede with His Excellency to prevent their coming. From principles of humanity to the country, from a general love of mankind, and from my persuasion that they were orderly people, I readily undertook it. And is there a man on earth who, placed in my circumstances, could have refused it? As I passed the people, I told them of my own accord I would return and let them know the event of my application. Still concerned, the Cambridge Committee sent dispatches to Charleston and Boston. Joseph Warren of the Boston Committee wrote, "A billet was brought requesting me to take some steps in order to prevent the people from coming to immediate acts of violence, as incredible numbers were in arms and lined the roads from Sudbury to Cambridge. I summoned the Committee of Correspondence, but, as care had been taken to caution every man who passed the ferry from alarming Boston, I judged it best not to inform the person who warned the committee of the business they were to meet upon. They therefore made no great haste to get together. After waiting some time, I took as many of the members as came in my way to Charleston, fearing that something amiss might take place. I saw the gentleman of Charleston, who begged us to move forward to Cambridge. On our way, we met the Lieutenant Governor Oliver. He said he was going to the general to desire him not to march his troops out of Boston. We thought this precaution good and proceeded to Cambridge." Later, while awaiting word of General Gage's intentions, the Boston Committee met with delegates from the country towns. The meeting was held at Captain Stedman's Inn. The Boston Committee members were surprised that the delegates had been selected that day for that purpose. Boston had leaders who would drink ale and decide what the crowds would do. The country people, however, were participatory, and the leaders were selected for each circumstance and only for the particular event. Unlike what had been occurring in Boston, these events were truly of the people. General Gage, at Oliver's request, decided not to march the troops. Gage, after having obtained as much information as possible, determined that the crowd was not a Boston rabble, but the freeholders and farmers of the country. Even though Oliver had aided the Patriots in avoiding a confrontation, he was later that afternoon forced to resign his appointment as Lieutenant Governor. His resignation effectively destroyed the government implemented by the Massachusetts Government Act. The people, as a whole, not through the leaders in Boston, had gained the initiative and control in the revolution, which would, in 8 more months, result in the War of Independence. The Powder Alarm, New England, September 2, 1774. As word spread throughout the northern colonies of the events in Cambridge, Charleston, and Boston, farmers and merchants dropped their work and picked up their arms. They began a massive march toward the Massachusetts Bay. Their alarm was supported by rumors, gaining momentum as the stories of what was transpiring traveled out and away from the more organized negotiations in Boston and Cambridge. Though estimates vary on the number of those who went to Cambridge, as well as those on the march toward what rumor had provided for, they range from a minimum of 20,000 to a maximum of, quote, near 100,000, close quote. As far as the distance to which the rumors carried and caused alarm, an account by Mr. McNeil from Litchfield, Connecticut, is given to the Reverend Ezra Stiles, is as follows. McNeil went to bed without hearing anything, but about midnight, or perhaps 1 o'clock, he was suddenly waked up. Somebody violently wrapping up the landlord, telling the doleful story that the powder was taken, 6 men killed, and all the people between there and Boston arming and marching down to the relief of their brethren in Boston. And within a quarter or half an hour, he judges, 50 men were collected at the tavern, though now deep in night, equipping themselves and sending off posts every way to the neighboring towns. They called up McNeil to tell the story of the Springfield affair, which was news. He said he had to repeat and tell the story over and over again to newcomers till daylight, so he had no more rest that night. The men set off as fast as they were equipped. In the morning, being Friday, September 2nd, Mr. McNeil rode forward and passed through the hole at the very time of the convulsion. He said he never saw such a scene before. All along were armed men rushing forward, some on foot, some on horseback. At every house, women and children, making cartridges, running bullets, and making wallets, baking biscuit, crying and bemoaning, and at the same time animating their husbands and sons to fight for their liberties, though not knowing whether they should ever see them again. I asked whether the men were cowards or disheartened by or appeared to want courage. No. Whether the tender distresses of weeping wives and children softened, effeminated, and overcame the men and set them to weeping too? No. Nothing of this, but a firm and intrepid ardor, heartily eager, and courageous feeder, a spirit of enterprise, a spirit for revenging the blood of their brethren and rescue our liberties. All this, and an activity corresponding with such emotion, appeared all along the whole tract of about 40 miles from Shrewsbury to Boston. The women kept on making cartridges, and after equipping their husbands, brought them out to the soldiers, which in crowds passed along and gave them out in handfuls to one and another as they were deficient, mixing exhortations and fears and prayers, and spiriting the men in such an effeminate manner as even would make cowards fight. He thought, if anything, the women surpassed the men for eagerness and a spirit in the defense of liberty by arms. For they had no thoughts of the men returning but from the battle, for they all believed the action commenced between the king's troops and the provincials. The women, under this assurance, gave up their husbands and sons, etc., to battle and bid them fight courageously and manfully and behave themselves bravely for liberty, commanding them to behave like men and not like cowards, to be of good courage, and play the men for our people and for the cities of our God and the Lord. Do as seemeth him good. They expected a bloody scene, but they doubted not success and victory. McNeil never saw anything like this in his life. He said, they scarcely left half a dozen men in town, unless old and decrepit, and in one town the landlord told him that himself was the only man left. This ends episode 5.